I wanted to be an author. I love words. And just going back to be able to do this, I've made this happen, to be able to get a publishing deal and to be able to write my story about being dyslexic and Black. And in writing that story, I have asked 20 other people who are dyslexic and look like me to be part of that journey with me, because I'm all about bringing other people into the framework where possible. And I wanted it to not just be about me, but to see other people like me who have dyslexic, and we've come through the other side, and these are our stories, because you don't hear our stories too much. No. The representation of us are not always seen, and that's where the change in the narratives come from. I want to change that.
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerek Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and Brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from.
Today, we have Marcia Brissett Bailey with us. I'm so excited. She is our first international guest. Marcia is dyslexic by design. She's a neurodiversity narrative changer, an influencer. She's Forbes featured, and she's an international speaker. So we're so excited to have you. So welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast.
Hey, Marcia.
Hey, just gratitude all around. You know, I'm just really grateful to be here, if that makes sense, in terms of the kind of title of what you're, you know, the narrative of what you're talking about, and having our voices and amplifying them and sharing our lived experience is just awesome. Thank you.
Yes, I was telling Derek before, I followed you faithfully on Instagram, and it took me a minute to realize that it was you on LinkedIn. So you probably don't realize this, but you hit me up on LinkedIn and I'm like, who is this? But then I'll be talking to you on Instagram and you probably were like, why is she not really responding? Because I didn't make the connection until like later. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's my person on Instagram. So when we started doing this, I was like, absolutely. Like in my mind, you were going to be on the show.
Absolutely. Like, I felt the same way.
Like it was a no-brainer.
Yeah. And if for everyone who's on LinkedIn, like I know you through LinkedIn. And so the post you put out, and you post every day, several times a day, and the material is always really, really good. And the audience can't see it, but you're blushing right now. But I not only, you know, enjoy following your work, but share the resources, and sometimes just the memes too. I think you capture so much of the dyslexic experience in just a really key way. And so just thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing. We have to share, we have to amplify, we have to, you know, equity, we need to lift each other up. And you guys have been awesome in doing that and really supporting me on my book journey as well and being part of that. So, you know, there's little quotes in there with you guys in it, and I'm just so thankful, because it's about a unity of family. We're family from different sides of the water, but that's how I see it.
That's right. Black doesn't just mean African American, right? You know, we're the larger diaspora. And it's just, and again, it's part of the reason I think why we're both glad that we're talking with you. So you're in London right now, right?
I am in the UK. I'm in London. Yep. So I could be more Pacific, East London. So if you've ever heard of Cockney or East End, that's where I am, and that's where I grew up. So I can switch to East End, but this is me generally. But you know, you can do coding, different coding, switching, just like dyslexic. You have to code switch and mask, and it's a lot of stuff, and it can be exhausting because you have to try to navigate into a society that doesn't always tell you you belong. You know?
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe just, can you just start with how you got connected to this work of neurodiversity and dyslexia?
Well, it starts with when I was born, but let's not even go there in terms of, you know, feeling like, you know, from the beginning. I'll tell you a little bit about the beginning and I'll get into how I got to where I am. So, you know, my parents are from Jamaica. They came here when they were very young, and they had me as teenagers. My mum was a teenager, just 19. You know, they really found it hard because they came at a time when they were young, when there was this whole, the racism kind of was really real in terms of no Blacks, no Irish, no dogs. You know, my grandmother was experiencing all that. And we, you know, have to come together as a tight community. And some of the things that my parents spoke to me about, it sometimes felt like it was about lack. We didn't have this, we didn't have that. Then you had my grandmother always saying to me, we've got to work twice as hard. So it wasn't that it was confusing, but they, from the beginning, it felt like there was something about belonging to something and not being connected, disconnected, not seeing yourself in things. So I already had that journey happening. I was so young. You know, like 8, 9, your grandmother's telling you, you've got to work hard. What was she talking about? But all I knew, it was something to do with the color of my skin, but didn't quite know. And I knew there was some kind of injustice. And that's a young child. As I sort of was growing through the education system, I would say I was in year 5. So this is like about 9, 10. I started to really feel like I didn't belong. I love school, but school didn't love me. I just couldn't connect. And I was zoning out, but I knew I had a brain. And when I say I knew I had a brain, I knew I had imagination. I knew I was able to think really broadly. I was curious about things. I was questioning things, but it slowly started to be crippled. I was being crippled at the same time. I was slowly starting to be told, you are an A student, or you are a, you know, no student. You know, it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense to how I was feeling in my head and what the teachers were telling me. And so what was, I think, the biggest thing, and this is when the trauma came for me, is when my teacher used to ask me to read. Now, I couldn't read. No one kind of clocked that. I wasn't really reading. And phonics didn't work for me. So they were sounding out these sounds, and it just didn't make sense. My brain wasn't processing it. Even if I tried to repeat it to you, I understand some of them, like the free words and stuff like that still. But anything bigger, it was just not happening. And I learned to read words as a whole or chunk them down. So when my teacher used to try to get me to read, I just wished the ground was swallowing me up. I was hoping that the bell would ring. My hands started to sweat. My heart was starting to race. Oh, it just really tore me apart. And in the end, I decided to, I thought I was really clever. I thought I'd be invisible by not speaking. So I became selective mute. I just stopped talking. I did speak because I was comfortable only when I was spoken to. But if I was invisible, no one would ask me to read. That was my thought process. It got so bad that my mum had to come to the school, and she started, in those days, you can go straight through the school gates, straight to the headmaster and knock on the door. Maybe that's the principal here, and you could just go and speak to them. So my mum came with her drums, you know, the invisible drums, because that's how you feel when your parents are coming to the school. So she's coming with these drums, and she's coming down to beat down the door and say, my daughter's not learning, she's 10, she can't read like her peers, you know, what are you doing about it? And my mum's really got a bit of an East End accent. So she's saying, what are you doing about it? You know, I'm not. And in the end, they got me to have an educational psychologist assessment. I remember that because it was all the shapes and all these kind of things. So I know what it is now, but at the time I didn't know. And then I ended up going to psychotherapy. Now, just to go forward to explain the psychotherapy, what my mum tells me now, and I never knew for years, I never asked her, it was because they thought something was happening in my home.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Rather than it being about learning. So I was thinking in my head, it was about something to do with how I was feeling at school. But my mum said to me, that's what they were thinking. They were trying to get to the bottom of it. It was something to do with what was happening at home, why I was displaying these behaviors, let's put it, because we know behaviors, which is a form of communication, displays lots of things to why some of our children are excluded, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So that's what happened to me. So I'm the quiet child, I'm conforming, because there's a clash of cultures already, because my parents, you got to behave, you got to listen, no thank you, yes please, respect your adult. So you're having so many, those intersections are so huge, and then you've got this thing what was happening to me, and it was just huge, and so much of a big impact in my life at such a young age, at 10, with the culture aspect, the not feeling like you belong in the school, trying to read, people laughing at you. And then I tell you what was the moment, what happened for me, when I was going to go what we will call secondary school, maybe it's high school, so I'm about 10, 11, so we transition to what we call secondary school, so it's a big upper school, and the teachers told my parents while I was sitting there, remember, I'm already invisible in my head, but this part I thought, no, I'm not invisible right now, this is like wrong in all levels. She told my parents that I was not going to academically achieve, Okay, so that's huge. And I'm sitting there because they felt that they can just say these things and say these things to my parents as a Black parents who were very young and probably still trying to understand the education system themselves because they came here and were already kind of told what they should be doing. My dad should be a builder, my mum should be a nurse, and that's their aspirations, and that was it because that's all they could do. Right. So I just thought, that's not me. That's not me. I'm not going to academically achieve. I felt there was something here, but I couldn't put it on the paper because I didn't have the tools. I didn't know why I didn't have the tools. And nobody, school's meant to be nurturing you, but not once were they nurturing me. I enjoyed school, don't get me wrong, but they weren't giving me the tools and they weren't identifying. If I could read my report, I wish I had it here to read you, but they were saying Marcy's well behaved. So that we ticked that box because already my parents told you, you don't come, you don't bring no trouble to home. So well behaved was good. As a Black child, you know,
I was very well behaved too, and charismatic and all that, and well groomed. Like, yeah, it's all in my documentation too. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, we have to come correct, right? So you're not bringing any of that thing to school because you know what you're going to get when you get home. You can't be bringing that. And as a girl child, it just wasn't even my thought process. So all of those things were great. But then they said, Marcia struggled. Marcia's this. She's, you know, getting there with her maths. So nobody ever identified it could be something else. So moving forward, secondary school, so 11 to 16, it feels like a blur. I like some of my subjects, but I don't know what the grading system there, but I came out with one grade that was what we called a B in drama. Now, if I had the tools to write a proper essay, I would have got an A. I was so much about imagination, play. I was able to sort of role play. I just loved performing. And I got that one B, I was happy, but their system failed me, right? So from school, we have to go legally in school from 5 right up until 16. And I came out with one qualification. So not maths, not English. I did dance, no languages, nothing. So something wasn't quite right, I would say. And I know now I can say it, and I didn't want to say it before because I was saying all these excuses. They were doing this for me, they were helping me, but they had failed me. And it was only when I got to college, and college is like from 16 to 19, when you're meant to be doing a subject, we have something called like A-levels or a vocational course that helps you to know, do your next step before you go to university. Right. To get those qualifications, but I had to retake my GCSEs. And it was only then that my government and politics teacher said to me, Marcia, you're speaking eloquently. How you speak is not how you're writing. There's some disconnect here. If you were to speak an assignment, you would get an A every time, but it's just not coming across when you're writing. It's not matching. And it was then he sent me to like a learning center. And then I got the diagnosis that I was dyslexic. So I hope that gives you a little bit of a journey. I've tried to give you a little bit of the intersectionality and all of those things that can be so confusing about what your parents or your family or your culture saying, and how in the classroom, then you don't speak. Because one of the things as well, you don't speak your business. So even if I was having difficulty, I couldn't speak it because I'm thinking they're an adult and I can't be rude. So there was a lot of crossing over of things that the rules, what was at home, but also the rules of listening and being told. It was really hard. So when I was told I was dyslexic, it took me a second because I didn't know what dyslexia really meant. But all I knew that it meant I wasn't stupid, because all through school, I was told about what I can't do. I was never told about what I can do. Does that make sense? Never saying, okay, these are your strengths. These are the things that you can move forward and develop. Nothing to make you build your confidence, your self-esteem. So already from like year 10, I'm already self-sabotaging. I'm already limiting beliefs. This has been developed through a school system, a system that is outdated, to be honest. You know, I've worked in the education system now for 30 years, and I can still see no innovation, no entrepreneur, no using technology to its strengths to enable people, you know, young people or adults to access learning. We're still in some kind of standardized testing that doesn't make sense for some of us who can't access it that way. But if I was able to talk an exam, I'm accessing learning. Why not? I'm not hacking the system, but that's what I felt like. I had to be a hacker. I had to find my own template to be able to get through the education system. That doesn't seem right. That feels criminal to me. Yeah. So you know, when I talk now, I don't feel the tears anymore. I used to really feel so tearful about it because I just think all of that time, what was wasted. But there's so many elements of it to do, you know, with those intersections about my environment, my education, where I was located. Was I just a statistic as a young Black girl? I don't want to speak, you know, in a negative way, but there's something about my environment where I was at the time, you know, there was things that we weren't accessing, because I know that I was failed. I know that for sure. I do know that.
It's the same way here in the States, just because of that, right? Like, it's the same stereotypes. You aren't being read to at home, or that, you know, little Black boys act out this way and it's deemed behavior. They focus on the behavior versus the academics. Like they said, like, something must be going on at your home. Like, what? Like, and it took them so long to identify you. And then did you get remediation? Did you start getting help? Although you learned you were dyslexic, but what happened then? Did you get help?
Yes. So actually, I put this in the book. So there was a lady called Jenny McWhinney who on my report, I found it. It says language learning support. So I still didn't realize, because dyslexia is not just about reading and writing. It's about language. So I'll have words and I just can't say them. I can visualize them. I can feel them. I can see them, but I can't actually get it out of my mouth. So sometimes I'll have to say to my family, you know, that word I'm thinking about is something that people do. You've got to get the word, if I'm going to make sure that makes a sentence in my piece of work, or I'm going to have to change it all around because I can't think of that word, which is really frustrating. But it's like it's at the tip of my tongue. So language is also part of that. I wouldn't say I think I had a stutter, more to do with the fact that I couldn't do phonics, but I became the stutterer at school, because I thought if I was doing that, the word would come. But it never came.
Right.
So the word never came, because I thought that's what you had to do. So they were teaching me, but not teaching me that to blend. But I didn't understand all of this. It was just like, oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting. I just really got lost in the system. It's a hard one, because now I work within that sector and all I want to do is give children and young people a voice. And some of the stories are still the same. We're still here in the same, like 20, 30 years later. What is going on?
And so what is the work that you do in education now? Can you share that with our audience?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I work for what we'll call a local authority. So it's within the government. And I'm an impartial support funded by the local authority. We'll have a SEND service, and I will be the impartial part at arm's length from that service within the government to impartially give advice, guidance, and empower parents to be able to advocate for themselves and be able to look at things like exclusion. What we will have is called SEND support in the classroom or in the school. So we'll look at the policies or that school has, if there's something not quite happening. We have something called an education healthcare plan, where for some children whose needs are maybe quite complex, and they'll do an assessment through the local authority. And if they get that plan, it's something will go with them from possibly through 0 to 25. So people can be born, you know, some people can be born with something, that you get that plan from when you're in the education system. I deal with exclusions, anything to do with special educational needs. And it revolves around that. But even if a child is undiagnosed yet, I can still work with that family. And it's just huge, because you've got where I'm located, it's very, very diverse, a whole range of different community groups, and language is a barrier if you don't speak the language and understand the system. There's so much work that could be done around that, and that requires funding and money, like translators, training for parents who are really, and also parents who feel isolated or excluded from their own communities because they've got a child with autism. It's so complex. And what I feel so, I don't want to say grateful, but I just feel I'm in a position to empower, but to make change where possible. But because I feel I have an understanding, and that's why I feel people who are dyslexic, neurodiverse, we can do it too. And we are really good at it because we have that empathy and understanding. I don't disclose necessarily at work, but when I'm talking, I can feel the energy. They're thinking, how does she know these things? How could she explain it like that without, I can feel that they're thinking, where is this all coming from? So I do use a lot of my lived experience, and I think that's valuable. And I feel that's really helps me in my job a lot. because I have an understanding, possibly. I'm not saying people who don't have a neurodiverse or dyslexic don't, but I feel that I do have that extra little magic there that does help me to be able to articulate the challenges that child or that young person may have, or that parent may have, just like my parents did. All my mum wanted to do was to make that I was happy and enjoying school. That's all she wanted. She didn't understand the all, you know, my mum never understood about what university really was about, you know, but she, all she wanted was the best for her. My nickname is Marcy. She just wants the best for her Marcy. And why can't parents have that? Why can't we have that? If you're saying we have to go to school, what is it about that system's not giving everybody a chance, the opportunity to dare to dream and have aspirations? Why not? Why not?
Yeah, no one can see because we're nodding our head and we're like, yes, yes, yes. And Lederic almost fell out of his chair when you were talking about not being able to get the word out, right? You can see it, you can visualize it.
But it's because we just did an interview, like prior to us talking now, we did an interview. And the first time I, you know, in recording was trying to ask a question. And I don't know what the word it was. It was probably more than five syllables. I got the first syllable in my head. I'm in the midst of asking the question, trying to recall the word, and then saying to myself, bro, it just ain't gonna happen. You're not gonna get the word. Restructure this sentence with some words you know you're gonna be able to recall. And that's, and you know, and I think when I was younger, oh, you know, it'd be all this negative self-talk. And now it's just kind of like, you know, that's just like Mr. Dyslexia showing up and just like, you just got to play with him here.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I know I'm smart. I know I got a good question. You know, I know all that stuff. It's just the mechanics of what's going on in my head. It's not allowing me to, you know, and I'm laughing because there are times when I'll say to my wife, like, okay, you know, this word, it means this. And then oftentimes I've got a couple syllables or I can kind of get the sound of it, but not all of it. And it's at times it's frustrating, but now I just kind of laugh at myself, you know?
And as a parent, yeah. I would tell my daughter when she was struggling like that, I'm like, you have a vast vocabulary, use your words, get it out. But I didn't know at that time, we didn't know she was dyslexic. So now I have more grace, I'm more patient, right? But I used to say, use your words, get it out, use your words. But now I'm like, oh my gosh, that was the absolute wrong thing to say, right? That, like, don't say that. But I didn't know. I didn't know. So when you were explaining, you know, your journey, I'm like, it's the same, right? It's here in the yeah. same. It's the same, right? I was a harsh, like a gung-ho advocate for my daughter because she was compliant, because I was that parent. You're going to be respectful. You're going to be respectful of adults. She would have gotten lost in the system because I know my child. She's compliant. She's polite. She's nice, right? And that was my biggest fear. She's going to get lost. And so I just, you know, put my gloves on and said, okay, let me fight this system best I can. So while you were sharing your story, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's the same. It's the same here. The same challenges you experienced, culture, girls, boys, just because you're Black, just because of the color of your skin, it's the same. That's just, it's yeah. the same.
So there's a connection there, but then how do we make that, not synergy, but how do we, what can we change? I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a bigger than us sometimes, it feels bigger than me, but I'm just gonna keep doing and keep trying to make change and sharing like we're doing in this platform. And talking about these lived experiences, which we've never felt before. I think the point of what I want to make about feeling invisible, sometimes I just felt that all over about invisible because, okay, so I'm a Black girl. Okay, so that's two things. Then you're telling me I've got dyslexia. Are you kidding me? You know, with all the other things I've got to deal with,
right.
Dyslexia, you're adding that on. Obviously, I've embraced dyslexia and it's part of my authentic self. But at the time, even like going into my 20s, it's just like, how am I going to mask this alongside? And I did. I got into jobs and I was having to mask. I stayed late. You know, I just had to try my best and I was attention to detail. So everything always looked good. So I always, even at university, all the detail, you always do the detail, the little details, because that will bring up your points, you know, because, you know, attention to detail. And that's how I had to get through in a lot of things. Not that I couldn't do the job, but it's all the linear kind of rope way of working. I had to present in a way that wasn't the way my brain functioned. And that's what makes it crippling.
You talked about you did some work on neurodiversity in business and in the workplace. Is that where that came from how you had to work so hard when you started in the workplace to start saying, okay, we know that children are struggling, but some of those children who never get any help, they still turn into adults, and then they're now in the workplace and they're still struggling. Did that kind of foster that drive to then focus on neurodiversity in the workplace?
So neurodiversity in the workplace is a bigger project, and I'm a part of the co-production of that. So as somebody who's neurodiverse and dyslexic, I'm part of the board of other neurodiverse dyslexics to talk about the workplace, because the workplace, it's a book in itself, but the workplace is quite an interesting place because it's just another version of school in my eyes. Let me just say it's in my eyes, okay? But with that, we're not necessarily, unless you're going to selective schools or private schools, you're not doing the interview process, right? Or the assessments. But generally in mainstream schools, you won't have that kind of application. I don't know for the US, but we don't generally, you will just apply and then you will be told whether you've got a place at that particular school.
Come on in, yes.
Right. Yeah, come on in. But in the workplace, you've got to apply now. So whether you've got a CV, you've got to do one of those to sort of say what your skill sets are, and then you put those to different jobs, or you've got to apply and have an interview and then have an assessment. That's getting the door. That bit's really tricky if you don't disclose. I always disclose, but I know it's really difficult because you've got to remind them you've got to do an exam, if you have to exam, which that's why some of my peers don't go for jobs, because they don't want to do the exams. So you go for the exam. I'm just reminding you, even though it was on my form, oh, I'm dyslexic, do I get the toy? That's a lot of energy. I'm having to remind you, you should be inclusive. I've already shared with you that I'm dyslexic. So what does that mean? How are you as part of your diversity or your disability policy? What's happening here? Do you see what I mean? This is now, I'm already feeling that I don't feel like this might be the right place for me, but you go along, you go for it, you remind them, then they've got to find a room. And if they find one, it's some cupboard, and then they're trying to find the paperwork to see, then check with someone, because she had the extra time. Now I feel like I'm really have this disability that's really causing you some problems now. Do you see what I mean? So from the offset, from the way you advertise a job, the way you make it approachable and accessible to others through just the advertisement, the way it looks, the people, the ethos of your mission of your company, because I look at all of that when I'm going to go for a job. I go into that much detail, but I am a careers advisor. I'm a qualified, trained careers advisor, and that's part of some of the work I've done in the past with my young people. So I know about applying for a job and looking at, even though we know not everything it looks like in a company necessarily is what's happening in the inside. So I feel there's something about HR and human resources and about that piece of work that sometimes organizations need to put their hand up and say they're not an expert, but they might need to bring somebody in, because you have to work from in the inside out. And why I say that, because there's lots of companies, and I'm not just talking about disability or dyslexia, but from a diverse equality kind of piece of work, there's lots, don't make assumptions about people. Do some work, ask people, ask your organization, ask your employees, what was your interview process like? What was your process coming into this company? Do we need to look at the way we do assessments? Are we excluding people or a pool of talent of people? Yes, you are. So I'm passionate about that piece of work, and where possible, I do a lot of talks. We have something called Access to Work. So it's a government initiative or funding. It seems like a big secret, but it's not. So when you go start an employment, you can apply for access to work, and that's what I think you call it accommodations, but it's reasonable adjustments. You can apply for equipment through your employers and through your HR or personnel to be able to get this funding through government, and they'll do an assessment. Somebody will come in and do an assessment in your workstation or wherever you're located to look at what will be some of the needs or resources that you might need to support you in your workplace to be able to do your job effectively. So because I disclosed, it should come up first time, right? No, I then need to remind them once I'm successful at that job, I'm going to apply for access to work. You've got your manager probably saying, I don't know what access to work is. So do you see this kind of ripple effect of nobody knows, the left doesn't know what the right's doing, but you're an organization you have people in your organization, which means personnel, people, human resources, but yet that person who's dyslexic, neurodiverse, is trying to navigate through all of these I call barriers or systematic barriers, which are not yours to have. It's about that organization doing their stuff to make sure that person feels included. I really don't feel included. I'm exhausted. And then you have an induction and what tells me about disabled. And I was thinking, are you kidding me? This looks like it's in the 1900s or something like that. This is what disabled people look like. It doesn't look like me or a person with a disability, because I will go in that. If I'm someone with a long-term condition or a processing, I fit in that, but that don't look like me. You've got somebody in the, I don't know, dinosaur age there. It's not up to date. It just look, you're going to feel exhausted. You already feel like you don't belong again. So we talk about diversity, we talk about inclusion, we talk about equity, and then I don't feel like I belong. So you're having to do all the stuff you felt possibly at school.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about the bullies. Do you know what I mean? In the workplace, I'm not even talking about that. So there's a lot of, I think the infrastructure, I can say for the UK, I'm not saying it's all bad. There's some companies doing some amazing work. And I know that some of the, I've heard, I don't know, but you get the impression like Google and some, like they're really kind of inclusive, you know, in those ways, in the way you work.
Ernest and Young, Fidelity, Microsoft, there are different companies that are understanding the value of having a diverse workforce. And then particularly as it comes to neurodiversity. And so, yeah, there are folks who are building out entire departments to take advantage of different abilities that come with having, you know, certain diagnoses.
And strengths and talents.
That's it. Absolutely.
And I know that I've got a lot of that. I'm an ideas person, so I don't go down well in some organizations because you've got your colleagues and like, oh no, here she goes again with another idea. But don't get me wrong, it's about sharing, right? So I've got an idea, but I have a little bit more of ideas. It's okay. And I've learned how to tone it down because maybe I've got an element of ADHD or something. It's like, oh yeah, I've got another one. It's like I get off on it. I was like, oh yeah, I've got another one. It looks like I'm the person who's looking for the sweets from the teacher pet. I'm not. I just like, that's me. I can't help it. And I've embraced it more because I used to think it's embarrassing, you know, like, why am I like this? But it's something about me. I like that. I like to think about different ways to navigate or ideas to think about the future. And I'm someone who likes to think about the end before the beginning. Yeah. And then my dad said, Marty, that's a good thing, that you can visualize what it would look like at the end. But then I have to go back to the beginning to bring people with me. But I know that's what I do, and that's okay.
And it's the dyslexic advantage. And I have the similar experience, you know, as I serve on boards and interact with the staff or, you know, the organizations, I say, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just keep throwing these ideas out. Now, I know probably 80% of them are for the trash bin, right? Like, you know, don't pay attention. But I know I'm also going to hit you with a few that, like, if you pay attention to me, they're going to be game changers, right? And so I think that's part of the advantage of, again, having that diverse workforce is having all these people who are, you know, because you want someone that's going to deal with the details, but you also want someone who's a visionary.
Visionary. And I just think they're missing a trick. And I think it does take a bit of work. I don't want to say it takes courage, but you need to do the inside work first in the infrastructure. And to get it right, speak to some of us, have us come in, talk to us, show that you want to. Some people can just shut it away. And then you have these bullies again that come in and then they're overseeing you or talk about performance management. And of course, obviously you've got a job description, but how are you best supporting that person to do the best they can be and be the best they can be? A lot of people neurodiverse, if they're in a good job, they don't want to leave unless they're just looking to move on after 3 years, which I realized that was a pattern. Every 3 years, I want to move on to a new job. But, you know, people, once they're happy, they don't want to, but it's the getting your foot through the door. And, you know, I started, my first degree was in information science. And can you imagine the world of information? So I've done database, websites, like security, firewalls, programming, that's my first degree. I'm really about acquisition of information. Look at where we are now. Google, it was ArcGIS. I remember all the different search engines I had to sort of create and do things, but I couldn't get my foot in the door. It was selective. And then the kind of jobs what was available, I could reach information officer. Oh my gosh, information officer, and I'm dyslexic. At the time, I didn't have the tools and those keys to be able to navigate the way I did now with all the assistive technology. Yeah, I could do that, do newsletters, you know, informal in the organization, but it just wasn't going to happen. So I didn't get into an industry that I studied 3 years for because of all of those barriers. So when I tell people I'm an informationist, I'm a qualified librarian, and the acquisition of information, how it disseminated, it's really interesting to me. That's why I probably like social media the way I do it, interact with it, because it's part of my DNA. I like that kind of information-ish. People think a librarian, books, and yeah, it doesn't, that's not about my dyslexia. That's who, do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so you've made a reference to this a few times, the book. So I know Winifred and I know that you're working on a book. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what the focus will be and when we can expect
Well, the expector, I don't know. It's with the publishers. So that bit, I can't say. I'm hoping it's for 2022, but it could be towards the end. I would say it's towards the end of the year. If it's going to come out, it's going to be towards the end of the year. So this book, I visioned it. That's not maybe not correct English, but I visualized from when I was at primary school that I wanted to be an author. And it was only when Maya Angelou, her stories, and because I know and I can say that it was trauma I was going through, I really felt the vibration of her stories and her poems in particular, and feeling almost human and all these kind of things. And it was then that I wanted to be an author. I love words, and just going back to be able to do this, I've made this happen, to be able to get a publishing deal and to be able to write my story about being dyslexic and Black. And in writing that story, I have asked 20 other people who are dyslexic and, you know, look like me to be part of that journey with me, because I'm all about bringing other people into the framework where possible. And I wanted it to not just be about me, but to see other people like me who have dyslexic, and we've come through the other side. And these are our stories, because you don't hear our stories too much. No. The representation of us are not always seen. And I want to change. That's where the change in the narratives come from. I want to change that. And we're here, and I want us to change that. We are being part of that here, having me hearing that story. I want my daughter to have a role model. My daughter's dyslexic, she's 15. I want her to be a role model as well. But how are we going to change that for that generation if we don't do something now? And since I found my voice in this space, I'm just like, wherever I can, I'm going to find, I don't want to get burnt out. And I'm aware of that, because if it's me just doing it, I have to pace myself. But at the same time, wherever I can, I'm going to be talking about it. So the book is so important. I thank you also, because we've just met online, both yourself, Zeric, and Winifred. And, you know, you've both put a quote in my book. And that's just, I'm just, had nothing but gratitude for you to, you know, share a little bit with me. I've got no words.
Oh my God. When you sent the email, you were like, will you write something? I was like, Marcia, what? You asking me? Absolutely. You a superstar in this space. So yes, thank you for asking.
Absolutely. It was a no-brainer. But like when you say about seeing and representation, that's how the podcast started. It started from a hashtag I did on Instagram, hashtag Black and Dyslexic. And that was my thing. The running joke is LaDerek, Sean, Clarice.
Sean, yes.
Like it was just like a handful of Black
folks. We all know each other.
We all know each other, and they would be on everybody's page, right? All the organizations who were claiming to be diverse or whatever would snatch a bio of them, and then they would show that. So I thought to myself, well, it's got to be more Black dyslexics because it's hereditary, and where are they? And I started doing that on Instagram, and I found athletes, and I found every day. That's when it really took off. I called them everyday dyslexics. My friend who's a principal, somebody I know who's a firefighter, somebody who's a police officer. And then it kind of took on a life of itself. And I'm like, wow, I started something. And then when I came up with the podcast idea, some people were looking at me sideways. I was like, no, it's going to be titled Black and Dyslexic. They were like, well, what about other people? I said, they'll learn. They'll enjoy it, but it's going to be Black and Dyslexic. And I was very intentional, and I held firm to that. And, you know, here we are in season two, you know, for that same reason. And a little girl, 11 years old, reached out to me and was like, Oh my gosh, thank you so much for posting that. I didn't know Usher was dyslexic, you know? And it was just like, oh wow, like this is something here. And I said, the podcast will allow me to expand, right? And to really reach all across the globe. Here we are, right? Here we are having this conversation.
I just feel so tearful because you know how long I remember feeling there's no one like me. When I was 16 and I was diagnosed, I was like, there's nobody who looks like me. I actually thought, don't tell anybody, I actually thought that it was like, I maybe as a Black dyslexic, I thought maybe I just got a bit of the white side. You know, I just caught this dyslexia but it was just me. I'm the only one. And do you go be like, I'm just like representing this. It was weird. I just thought, I can't explain it. I just thought it was I just got it from the white people. It sounds sad to say that, but that's what I thought because that's how my world was. It's black and white. So how did I get this?
Yeah, and you know, I have friends that are doing work to support students with dyslexia in Kenya. And that's one of the more common cultural kind of beliefs, right? Like this is a white people thing. And it doesn't help that so many of the people whose voices get amplified are just telling the story of dyslexia through white narratives. And so, you know, even for those of us who are oftentimes highlighted, like we still need just more stories, a diversity of stories. There's, you know, the danger of the one narrative, right? And so the you know, books, podcasts, you know, conversations at the grocery store, like we all need to be sharing our story and our experiences. Because yeah, there, I mean, and I'm fighting back the tears too, right? Like it's very pain. Yeah. And it's, and you know, as you were telling your story about going through school, I was thinking about myself in primary school and seventh or eighth grade and being so angry, right? And realizing that like something was wrong, but not being able to really point at what it was. And I didn't have the sort of thought that like the system was failing me. The system is flawed, right? Yeah. You know, I knew that like if it was someone who was bullying me, well, we could just get in a fight and then like, there it is, right? Yeah. But as a little kid, you know, and particularly as someone who was, you know, quiet, right? I wasn't always kind of like lashing out and that kind of thing. It's hard to figure out where the problem is. And I think, unfortunately, for many of us, we start thinking that we must be the problem, you know? And then you're right, if you layer in issues around, you know, like, you know, we're talking ableism, but racism is also at play here, and then sexism. I mean, you get caught in that lattice of isms, and, you know, you're actually trapped in a web, and it can be really hard to know how to move out of that.
And I know, you know, you sort of almost, people might want to make you feel like you're paranoid, but I know from some of my amazing allies who are white, you know, you were diagnosed at 6, 7, 8, 9, what? You know, and I'm told I was lucky from some of my friends and people in the book, a load of the people in my book, they got diagnosed when they were at university. Say they didn't go to university, they wouldn't know what it was, and they could have been, you know, shooting out all sorts of things and not sure or knowing what it was actually about. Yeah. They totally got missed. I mean, and they're like 30 in their 30s and 40s when they got diagnosed. So
yeah, we have this experience of dumbing our lives down, you know, of just like not being able, you know, not feeling like we can step into the fullness of what our potential is. I mean, it's informed by trauma. And I think a lot of us start closing down our possibilities at very young ages, you know, at very young ages. And that's not to say that like everybody needs to go to college, you know, like there are all kind of different, right. Yeah. There are all kind of different pathways out there, but we should all be seeking whatever help we need. And we would hope that we are building societies, no matter where you are in the world, where our systems are recognizing and giving people the supports that they need in a way that is really empowering.
What I called it was folks are underemployed. And when you talk about taking certain tests and assessments to move up, to move ahead, those who are struggling and never been diagnosed and never got any interventions, they have low self-esteem. They know they can do the work, but the process to get there, they don't even try. When I worked in, I worked a lot in HR and I worked in recruitment and I would interview folks and I knew that they could do the job, but I also knew there was a 100 question assessment with one particular employer. And so I didn't know then how to articulate it and how to explain, like, we're not doing something right. At this time, my daughter was just getting diagnosed when I was doing this work. But then it made me think about when I was an adjunct professor in college, some of my students, adult learners too, I was just so happens that I only taught at the college level, non-traditional adult learners. And I'm like, wait a minute, when we talk, when we have conversations, but this is not translating in this resume, because I'm teaching them, I was in career services, I'm teaching them how to write resumes and cover letters and, you know, LinkedIn profiles. And I'm like, why is this not adding up? And it was only later that I realized, like, wait a minute, I bet you a lot of them had learning disabilities and just didn't know it, right? Mm-hmm. And so then that's what made me think, okay, I've got to do something for the workplace as well, because so many of us, so many Black people don't get identified. They find out in the university, but what if they don't go? Then they go and work jobs that work against it, because those jobs are easy access. The jobs that are easy to get in are the ones that typically work against it. So then now you're in this role and you have anxiety, right? And now it's triggering other mental health issues because you just didn't know that you learned differently. And all you need is some tools and support to be successful. Yeah.
Marcia, can I ask, because Winifred just used the term learning disability. And I remember the first time I presented in London, and maybe I caught this wrong, but the term learning disability, I think it means something very different, like in the UK versus here in the US. Like, is it more like developmental disabilities? Am I remembering that right, or am I wrong there?
I think there's different terminologies depending on the different theories or thoughts. And so there's different chains of thought. It's like having the word neurodiversity. Some people, you know it begins with autism, but it's become an umbrella. But learning, I say learning differences, but there's learning difficulties. It's going to have different people having different views on it, complex needs. It's just, there's different learning. Yeah. So I understand when you're saying it, but different people will have it understood in different ways. And people who are coming more from a champion will think about learning differences. People more want to be more inclusive. So it varies. So I'm with you, but I do hear what you're saying. There are people who might pull you to say it's this term, but it's different it depends on the way you're framing it, I guess, the context, if that makes sense, because we always, I think for me, want to have a positive, but we know because it's the society that how it's set up is what makes, I would say sometimes us disabled, because if we're looking more of a social, we need the medical model to diagnose, but the social in terms of how we maneuver the world, the system's not set up including us in that way. So that's where the disability for me comes, because I am part of the disability movement, but at the same time, the structure of the system is what makes me disabled, because if I had it presented a different way, like if I was speaking, oh my gosh, yeah, you don't want to be hearing me speaking all the time, but you know, I could access it in a different way. But because we have to have an assessment and then you're testing my memory, well, that's going to make me at a disadvantage, because I can remember something literally when I was 4. But if I was in something with you and we were speaking, I might just forgotten that little bit because my memory just doesn't remember it that immediately, but it might come back to me in 5 years. Or no, not as long as that, but I'm just exaggerating a bit, but do you know what I mean? So you're testing me on an exam at the end of the year, but if you did it in stages, so continuous assessment or something like that, that may be a better way of seeing if I, you know, but if you, because it's not about my IQ, right? So I didn't know that when I was young. I thought that was it. You're, if you got this or you've got that, it's to do with IQ and that you've gotten, but it's not. So then if you could do it, but why not? Why can't we do assessments in a different way? Why are we now going back to these real traditional assessments where you can't do coursework as well as assessments? Because I'm really good on coursework, but you're now only doing exam, that's not gonna work for me. So there's the way our structure is, it's almost like it feels deliberate to exclude people. That's how I feel, do you know what I mean? Because it doesn't work and we know that. So that's why I feel we need more of us in the system. And I'm trying to hang on to stay in the education system, but it's really hard because there's a lots of things about it that's just not working. And nobody's got the guts to actually say to whoever's in charge to say, we need to start again. Yeah. That was what was, you know, this was in the 1900s, you know, but we're no longer building factories. So, you know, what we're going to do here, there's no conveyor belt. What did my son say to me? Mummy, why is it we're building people for, to be employees, but not business owners? What do I say to that? You know, you know, we need to look at that.
Yeah.
Children don't want to go to school sometimes because they feel bored because what they did in lower set of school and then they're going into high school, it's the same thing. Why are we repeating it? Why can't we? So it's something about our education system and changing it. It's like we seem to want to keep doing the same. History's showing in us it's not working now, not for now, with technology and everything, you know?
Yeah. For listeners who, because we don't, we don't know where the podcast goes, right? People listen from all over the world. But if you're in London, if you're in the UK, can you maybe just cite some resources? Are there organizations that are doing really great work around supporting students with dyslexia? You know, agencies, any sort of folks who you think are doing well, who you'd like to highlight?
Okay. So there are lots of different organizations doing pockets of different things in different ways. So there's a few people I've been working with, and there's an organization called Genius Within. They deal with the workplace in particular. They deal with work to do within the I don't say criminal system, but in the youth justice system. So you've got Dyslexia Scotland, you've got the British Dyslexia Association, you've got so many. You've got Amanda Kirby, who's doing some great work. There's just so many different people, especially now. I think sometimes people are not breaking away, but they're, you know, like have ideas about how they can form things and getting funding to do different things. I'm working with on a project called the Homecoming Project, and it's to elevate and support Black disabled people within the workplace or who are not working or not working. I'm doing some networking with that, getting people through the program to get coaching. I'm just thinking if there's anything else. I'm sure I've missed some out, but there's loads of different organizations out there. But yeah, you've got the British Dyslexia Association, which is the kind of umbrella for dyslexia, but there are other organizations, like I said, Scotland Dyslexia. And yeah, there's a few, and I'm sorry, I probably should have had a list ready to give you. I'm just trying to pop them out of my head. This is just the thing, my brain's like, and I'm going, no.
We could have of course asked you beforehand to put the list together, and yeah, folks can take a look in the show notes. I'll drop some of those links, but
yeah,
if there are any others that you should think of, you know, we can add them in there as well.
Yeah, I will send you some, but there's some great work going on. There's some real groundbreaking work, really trying to understand how we can have that balance within the workplace. But the school education, it's one that's still, there's still some work to do. So I just want to say, you know, I think one of the things that I just want to, you know, mention, and I think I've talked about, is about that intersectionality. And I feel as Black people, we really need to look at that and what that means. We talked about trauma. I not only was having the trauma what I had at school, I was carrying the trauma from my parents as well. There is something that we're carrying, and how do we change that narrative? How do we start to look at that by these kinds of conversations, by being open and also being vulnerable? People say to me, you're so vulnerable, but this is just my story. I can't change it. So I talk about it, hopefully to help others. I've done a lot of healing in myself, done a lot of inner child work. You know, we talk about the sabotage, the imposter syndrome. You're talking and you're thinking, oh my gosh, Marcia, shut up. You know, why are you talking to these 200 people? Who do you think you are? Where's that coming from? That's coming from a place sometimes of feeling that I'm not good enough, or that lack of, is this financial, or is it, it's been a lot of things that have been embedded into me as a child, always feeling that you don't have this, or this is not enough, because you're a Black person, you can't get into this, there's a glass ceiling. It's so much, and you having to, you can imagine your brain just buzzing, how are you going to perform today? Who am I going to be today? Am I going to be Marcia, the dyslexic, or going to be Marcia? It's, you know, it's so many things. So the fact that we're talking about this, we just need to keep doing this to hopefully empower others to be able to find their voice. I'm telling you, there are people, and you, I'm sure you know people, who would, they could never do this. They could never be on here talking about it. And it almost, they feel like they're exposing themselves for one thing. What will people think? That stigma, that all of those things they're carrying sometimes from our ancestral, like feeling like exposing yourself in this way. It's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of stuff. And I don't know how we start unpacking it and taking some of those layers down, because obviously in each individual, we have to do that work ourselves. We've got to do that inner work. Just like I said, the company needs, that inner work needs to start from us. But the conversations for people to feel they've got a safe space to talk about it is also important as well. So the work that you're doing, I'm, you know, Winifred, I'm sure your people are sharing with you because they feel safe. And those spaces in, yeah, but the trauma's real. Trauma's real. I don't know if I'm giving you anything to, you know, to take from that, but it's so real. And, you know, I know that even though I felt a tear in my eye, I feel it because I feel like to think that, to put a child through that and to know that, you know, that, you know, I could just be that statistic, and it's just not right. It's criminal. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I, sometimes people will ask me, you know, whether, I would change my childhood, you know, like change my experience, you know, or even go as far as to say, you know, would you get rid of your dyslexia if you could? And, you know, particularly for the question around changing my experience going through school, I actually say no, because I know wrestling through those experiences have made me the person who I am today. Mm-hmm. But what I firmly believe is I am going to work to make sure that no one else has to go through the same sort of experiences that I went through, right? Like, we know that we can do better. And so we should be doing better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Wonderful. This has been just a rich conversation. And again, we appreciate it. And we absolutely will have you back when your next book drops.
Yeah.
You know, you can speak it up and, you know, we can continue this conversation. So we're going to have links to your social media in the show notes, but if people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
Through my LinkedIn, through Marcia Brissett Bailey. Yeah, that's the best place to link with me. Yeah.
And then, you know, if this is like closing us out, if there's one thing that you just want to leave with a message to, you know, and let's talk to the hometown. Let's talk to London town, right? Like if you got a Black family, you know, what's one piece of advice you would have for them if they have a child that they think maybe has dyslexia or maybe was recently diagnosed? What sort of advice would you have?
You know, one of, from a parent's perspective, I just say, you know, you are an expert on your child. So don't give up, because we know our children well. So we are the experts, but we need that professional advice. But don't give up. Don't feel like you're going on or you're nagging. Never give up. And for the dyslexic person, it's also, that's what saw me through. I had hope and I didn't give up. And I started to ask people, because culturally it was, there's this thing, you don't talk your business, right? So how am I going to tell somebody I need help when you don't ask people for help, or say that this is kind of like a weakness? So you don't tell people because you're proud. But that was never me. I was just wanted to get along. So I say, talk if you can, if you feel comfortable and safe, talk to somebody who you feel comfortable and so maybe can help you. And not just keep persevering, try and take little steps at a time, because it can be so conflicting. But to find trust in somebody to talk about it and see if they can help you to navigate what you could do next, to signpost or to get the right, you know, information from an organization or something like that, if you feel something's not quite right. So learning to be able to speak your truth and share it with somebody who you feel comfortable with, and not to give up.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, there you have it. Coming to you from the UK, our first international guest, Marcia, thank you so much.
Oh, you're most welcome. As I said, it's just gratitude. I'm just loving this space and this platform. So thank you for having me.
Tune in next week, where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.